We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. This is Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas for your coronavirus update for Tuesday, December 8th, 2020. Here are some of the stories that are coming up today. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine data published in peer-reviewed journal confirms 70% efficacy. Pfizer vaccine provides some protection after first dose, FDA finds. Administration official explains why U.S. passed up a chance to buy more Pfizer vaccine. Key pandemic relief programs are set to expire in just weeks. Here's where stimulus negotiations stand. CDC official hopes to be able to speak out more next year and regain public's trust. Restaurants urge Congress to act after 110,000 restaurant closures. And we'll read a slightly longer story that's titled, What 7 ICU Nurses Want You to Know About the Battle Against COVID-19. First, we'll check the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County, total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,804. Ector County negative, 28,963 out of 37,273 tested, with 506 pending, 125 deaths. Recovered, 6,002. Active, 1,677. ECISD daily cases, 19 students, 14 staff. Midland County, 6,062 confirmed, 103 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas reports almost 8,800 people hospitalized for coronavirus. Average new cases in Texas increased by 3,176 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On December 7th, 8,712 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations decreased by 110 patients compared with a week ago. As of December 7th, 8,790 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 65 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On December 7th, 33 new deaths were reported. Now we'll move to coronavirus briefs. The Food and Drug Administration has confirmed the safety and efficacy of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine candidate. The review also found evidence that the vaccine, which is given in 2 doses, 3 weeks apart, began to protect people after the first dose. More on that in a story coming up in just minutes. Britain announced Monday morning it had begun administering the Pfizer vaccine, becoming the first Western country to begin a mass effort to inoculate people against the coronavirus. Pfizer has told the Trump administration it cannot provide substantial additional doses of its coronavirus vaccine until late June or July because other countries have rushed to buy up most of its supply. The scientists at AstraZeneca and the University of Oxford on Tuesday became the first vaccine developers to publish their full data in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, confirming earlier claims that the vaccine is 70% effective overall, but data suggests the need for more trials. Police with guns drawn raided the Florida home of Rebecca Jones, the data scientist who said she was fired by the state health department for refusing requests she felt were unethical. By January, nearly 12 million renters will owe more than $5,000 on average in unpaid rent and utilities after losing their jobs during the pandemic. The U.S. is adding cases at the fastest rate during the pandemic as the country nears 15 million total infections. President Trump is expected to sign an executive order to prioritize the shipment of COVID-19 vaccines to Americans, a White House official said. Now here are some shorter articles. AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine data, published in peer-reviewed journal, confirms 70% efficacy, from CNN's Jacqueline Howard. Drug maker AstraZeneca's coronavirus candidate was found to have 70.4% efficacy in an interim analysis of Phase 3 trial results, published for the first time in a peer-reviewed journal. The findings fall in line with the efficacy that AstraZeneca previously announced in November for its vaccine, developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford. The analysis, published in the journal The Lancet on Tuesday, found that the vaccine's efficacy in trial participants who received two full doses of the vaccine was 62.1%, and then efficacy in those who received a half dose followed by a full dose was 90%. Overall vaccine efficacy across both groups was 70.4%. The researchers from the University of Oxford, AstraZeneca, and other institutions around the world wrote in the study. Here we present the first interim safety and efficacy data for a viral vector coronavirus vaccine, CHADOX1, in COV-19, evaluated in four trials across three continents, showing significant vaccine efficacy of 70.4% after two doses and protection of 64.1% after at least one standard dose against symptomatic disease with no safety concerns, the researchers wrote. More on the study. The study includes data from trials conducted in the United Kingdom, Brazil, and South Africa between April and November. The safety data are based on more than 20,000 participants, and the efficacy data is based on more than 10,000 participants. The study says that across all four studies, the vaccine had a good safety profile. There were 175 severe adverse events in the trials total, 84 events among those who received the vaccine, and 91 in the control group. Three events were classified as possibly related to a vaccine, according to the study. Those included a case of hemolytic anemia, transverse myelitis, and high fever. There were four deaths during the course of the trials, but all were unrelated to the vaccine, caused by a road traffic accident, blunt force trauma, homicide, and fungal pneumonia. Pfizer vaccine provides some protection after first dose, FDA finds, by Carolyn Y. Johnson, Lori McGinley, Chris Alcantara, and Aaron Steckelberg of The Washington Post. A two-shot coronavirus vaccine developed by Pfizer and German firm BioNTech appears to be on the cusp of U.S. regulatory clearance after a 53-page review published Tuesday confirmed that the vaccine appears to meet the standard for emergency use authorization. The Food and Drug Administration briefing document is the first hint of U.S. regulators' assessment of the vaccine as the agency's career scientists approach one of the most momentous decisions in the FDA's history. It is also the most detailed independent review yet of data that has so far been known only through company news releases. The FDA's career scientists undertook their own thorough analysis of the data over the last 2 weeks and confirmed Pfizer's assessment that the vaccine regimen was 95% effective at preventing disease in a large clinical trial and had tolerable short-term side effects, including sore arms, fatigue, headaches, muscle pain, and chills that typically dissipated within 1 or 2 days. The review also found evidence that the vaccine, which is given in two doses, 3 weeks apart, began to protect people after the first dose. Administration official explains why U.S. passed up a chance to buy more Pfizer vaccine, from CNN's Jim Acosta. Officials leading the White House's Operation Warp Speed effort to mass produce a coronavirus vaccine passed up a chance to purchase more than the current 100 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine as part of a concerted effort to keep the administration's options open to other vaccines being developed at the same time, an administration familiar with the situation said. They shouldn't have closed the door to securing more Pfizer doses at the time the purchase was made, the official said. They could have left the door open to buying more Pfizer doses, the official added. The official said the decision was made as part of a plan to diversify the nation's vaccine arsenal through the purchase of millions of doses from Pfizer's rivals. At the time, officials at Operation Warp Speed had no idea the Pfizer vaccine was going to be this effective. The plan was to diversify and don't put all your eggs in one basket, the official continued. Now, the U.S. simply may have to hope that the other vaccines being produced by other companies are just as effective as the Pfizer doses, the official said. If other vaccines being manufactured by Pfizer's rivals don't perform at the same level, it could have a detrimental effect on inoculating the American public, the official said, noting it may be difficult to match Pfizer's efficacy rate. It's going to look bad, the official continued, if the other vaccines don't perform as well as the doses from Pfizer. But the official said the hope is that the other vaccines will be as effective as the Pfizer doses. Additional reporting from CNN's Ali Main. Key pandemic relief programs are set to expire in just weeks. Here's where stimulus negotiations stand. And from CNN's Lauren Fox. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell summed it up on Monday. We are down to the wire. If there is going to be a stimulus deal, if millions of Americans who depend on expanded unemployment benefits are going to continue getting that help, Congress has to come to an agreement, and soon. Here's a look at where stimulus negotiations stand. The sticking point. The issue for the bipartisan group is liability insurance. That's why you didn't see them unveil legislative text Monday. And it is why the group talked again into the night for several hours. For months, including liability protection was standing in the way of talks between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. And it is still standing in the way of benefits for millions of Americans. This is the item that Republicans are insisting on, not unlike how Democrats have been pushing for months to ensure state and local governments get another round of funding. Democrats know that they don't get state and local funding without finding a path forward on liability, and Republicans know they don't get liability without something for state and local. Aides say the meeting Monday night was productive, and it served as an opportunity for members to vent and lay out each party's side of the liability issue, but there still isn't a resolution. Areas of potential compromise. It's possible that if senators can't find an agreement, the bipartisan group could decide to take out state and local and liability and move forward without them. Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah told CNN that Monday night. McConnell on the floor Monday told Democrats that Congress does not need to resolve every one of our differences to get badly needed relief out the door. The big question is, could you actually get enough Democrats to vote for a package that did not include state and local funding? Most members I've asked about this have said they can't agree to anything without it. Where most lawmakers do agree. Funding for vaccine distribution. Another round of Paycheck Protection Program loans for small businesses. Funding for schools. Continuation of long-term unemployment benefits so individuals can get the benefits for 39 weeks instead of just 26. Extending the eviction moratorium. What could come next? Now that there is an extra week on the congressional calendar, some of the pressure might be off the bipartisan group to come up with a deal so quickly. The reality is that the momentum visible last week was a direct result of pressure folks were feeling with the December 11th spending deadline. This stimulus package was always going to be attached to the long-term spending deal, and with that deadline kicked off until December 18th, there is more time. More time can be good in that it gives negotiators room to find a middle ground, and in this case, it gives a group of lawmakers who are operating without committees time to write a bill. But it can also backfire. Congress operates best and most efficiently when its back is against the wall. More time means that these talks can drag out, giving more people time to nitpick and change their minds. CDC official hopes to be able to speak out more next year and regain public's trust, from CNN's Maggie Fox. A top Centers for Disease Control and Prevention official, who has been largely silenced through the pandemic, spoke out Monday and said she hopes her agency will be able to communicate more openly next year and regain the public's trust. When I walk into the office at the CDC, which I am maybe once a week, there's a pledge on the wall in big letters. The CDC's Dr. Nancy Messonnier said in a fireside chat with the Aspen Institute. It's the CDC pledge to the American public, and one of the things it says is that we base all public health decisions on the highest quality scientific data that is derived openly and objectively to place the benefit to society above the benefit of our institution. Messonnier, the director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, has in past disease outbreaks and epidemics been front and center briefing reporters and the public about diseases and the efforts to fight them. She has barely been seen since she last briefed reporters in March. Asked about this, Messonnier said she hoped that would change. What I hope for next year is that CDC and our staff will be able to communicate regularly and consistently across all levels of the government, she said. And that by doing that, by being transparent about the vaccine process, we will be able to regain the trust of the American public. Health transparency through the vaccine process will encourage people to get vaccinated. Many public health experts have complained that the Trump administration has sidelined the CDC and its usual role in educating the public about disease outbreaks. President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to take the coronavirus pandemic response in a dramatically different direction. Restaurants urge Congress to act after 110,000 closures, by Hamza Shaban, Washington Post. Nearly one in five U.S. restaurants have closed long-term or for good, amplifying calls from business leaders for emergency government aid as plunging temperatures and surging infections threaten to crush an industry already battered by the coronavirus. More than 110,000 independent, chain, and franchise restaurants have closed this year, according to a survey published Monday by the National Restaurant Association, a Washington-based trade group. The vast majority of restaurants that have permanently closed had been operating for more than a dozen years, highlighting how even well-established eateries have not been spared from the disruptions and economic devastation of the pandemic. And as winter approaches, limiting outdoor dining because of the cold, prospects for business continue to look bleak. Of the 6,000 restaurants and 250 suppliers surveyed by the group, almost 60% said they expect continued furloughs and layoffs in the next 3 months. About 10,000 restaurants have shuttered in the past 3 months alone. And now here is that longer piece from the Washington Post. What seven ICU nurses want you to know about the battle against COVID-19, published December 7th, 2020. They have been at this for almost a year. While politicians argued about masks, super spreader weddings made the news, a presidential election came and went, and at least 281,000 Americans died, nurses reported for work. The Post asked seven ICU nurses what it's been like to care for the sickest COVID patients. This is what they want you to know. Corey Albee, 31, COVID Unit Intensive Care Nurse and Unit Supervisor, St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center. Our staff are getting sick. Our physicians are getting sick. And they're not getting it from the hospital. They're getting it from the community. We are almost lucky to care for the COVID patients because we know who they are. Anytime we go into these rooms, we know exactly what we need to do. We have all the PPE we need. And as long as we are diligent and follow all the processes that are in place, we can keep ourselves safe. That's not what worries me at all. Going out into the community is scarier than coming into work every day because you don't know who has it. This virus has caused this feeling, this sense of isolation. The COVID unit is an isolated desert. Every door is shut. Every room has negative airflow. By the time you put your N95 mask on and then your surgical mask over the top of that, then you put your isolation gown on and your face shield on top of that, you can't tell who is who. So much of healthcare is about that personal touch. Now our patients can't even see our name badges because they are on under our gowns. All they see are our eyes through our face mask. A lot of families are hesitant to have Zoom calls with patients because it can be uncomfortable and awkward, especially if these patients are sedated and intubated. There's always that awkwardness of, can they hear you? Can they not hear you? Even as nurses, we feel like we're talking to the wall, but we talk to them as if they were awake, allowing families to play their music they like or pray with them or just talk to them. Can absolutely help. You see vital signs change. One patient, all she wanted to do was to have her son sing her a song. I think I spent over an hour in the room listening to him play the guitar and sing her a song. He sang her mostly hymns. Death is a very intimate event that normally involves a lot of family members that help bring closure and that helps everyone process. In normal circumstances, healthcare providers form these relationships with the family at the bedside. All of that has been removed, and we now have to try to form those relationships over the telephone. It's a traumatic experience, and it's a long, drawn-out process. A lot of people don't make it out of here. It's a slow, lonely death. The amount of death with COVID is profound. As nurses, we have learned to process death, but the amount of death has happened in such a short span of time, that's what's been overwhelming. I had a patient that we did a Zoom call with. His 4-year-old granddaughter lived with him, and she brought tears to the room. The naivete of a 4-year-old. Her grandfather was intubated, so he couldn't talk. But he could kind of look around the room. But the innocence of her saying, "Come home, Pa, I miss you. Pa, I love you, Pa," all through the video screen. The 14-year-old that also lived with them couldn't formulate words to say anything, and he didn't know what to do or say in that video. But the 4-year-old was telling Pa to come home. As told to Carissa Wolf. This comes from Jackson, Mississippi. As of December 8th, Mississippi has seen 167,926 total confirmed cases, 4,017 deaths, and 1,188 people are currently hospitalized with the virus. Katie Kerrigan, 28, ICU, University of Mississippi Medical Center. There are some patients who have been in their younger 20s and their younger 30s, and I think maybe those are the hardest cases. They have families and they have kids, just like I do, and it's hard coming into work and taking care of them, knowing they're supposed to be going to college, they're supposed to be getting married, they're supposed to be having kids, and instead, they're lying in a hospital bed on a ventilator, fighting for their life. They have their whole entire lives ahead of them, And then they get hit with this disease that everybody thinks is a hoax, and then they die. I worked in the ER a month ago, so I know exactly what's going on down there. And now I work in the ICU, so I know exactly what's going on both sides of it. There are no ICU beds in the hospital. None. When there are no ICU beds, we hold them in the ER or we hold them in the PACU, post-anesthesia care unit. The ER still has to treat our trauma patients, our car accidents, our gunshot victims. So when we have those ICU holds in the ER, it obviously makes the jobs of nurses and doctors in the ER way more difficult than it needs to be. We are treating patients in the hallway. They're just trying to do the best they can with the resources that we have. There is no room left, essentially, and I think that's what people don't seem to understand. And I get it. When you're not in healthcare, you don't really see our side of it. But we're seeing the worst of it. It's hard for us to convey that to the public because they don't seem to want to take our word for it. But take our word for it. Take our word for it. As told to Sarah Fowler. Iowa City. As of December 8th, Iowa has seen 244,844 total confirmed cases, 2,717 deaths, and 898 people are currently hospitalized with the virus. Allison Wines, 39, Medical Intensive Care Unit, University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. I cry every day when I walk into work, and I cry every day when I walk to my car after work. You get it out of your system before you show up and do your job and you're fine. Then you go home and you cry before you get home, and then you go home and be mom. My 9-year-old daughter asks frequently, "Mommy, how many patients were there today? Mommy, how many sick ones were there today? Were you safe? Was everything okay? Do you have to go to work again? How many patients?" She gets it. I think one thing that people do not appreciate is it's not only the number or volume of patients that comes through. It's the level of care that they require, which is so much greater than a standard patient in the ICU or a standard patient in the floor, because they can get very, very sick very quickly. We were walking a patient who was on ECMO, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and it took 5 people to walk her. That's not normal. I work in the MICU, so it's never like a party in here, but it used to be at least 9 times out of 10, calm and controlled, and tidy and clean. Occasionally, stuff would go bad, and we would all run and help, and then we would all go about our days. Now, it just feels like, especially of late, there is equipment everywhere. There are gowns everywhere. There are gloves everywhere. There are people everywhere. And there are fires everywhere. I'm actually scared, and I've never been scared at work before. I am scared that we will lose control. It's the human resources we are running low on. We can make a bed. We can find a ventilator. We have PPE. But it's the human cost of caring for these patients that has been keeping me up at night the past couple of weeks and really making me nauseous every day. I didn't think it would be over by now, but I didn't think we'd be getting hit this hard this late. I thought we'd still just be smoldering. I didn't know that we would just be a raging fire at this point in time. We're not prepared for that, but here we are. After this, I'm going to take my kids to a beach or somewhere. As told to Liz Lenz. Glenview, Illinois. As of December 8th, Illinois has seen 796,264 total confirmed cases and 14,216 deaths. Louisa Alog Pennepacker, 51. ICU, Glenbrook Hospital. I've taken care of a lot of husband-wife patients, unfortunately. One of the cases was one in which the husband had tested positive for COVID first, but he was a mild case. She was a little bit more serious. She ended up on our unit. The husband ended up in the hospital the next day, but he was on the step-down unit. When I admitted her, she was terrified, especially knowing that her husband was upstairs in another unit. She was having a hard time breathing, and she grabbed onto my hand and looked at me. She goes, "Am I gonna die?" I mean, I didn't know what to say, and I just told her, "Not on my watch." So we just kept on going. But ultimately, unfortunately, she got intubated the next day. Then I was sent to work upstairs on the step-down unit. I had her husband the next day, and he was actually quite happy that I saw her. He goes, "You took care of my wife? How is she? I heard that she's not doing well." I didn't know what to say to him either. I just said, "You know, she's in the best of care. We'll take really good care of her." And he looked really relieved. He goes, "I'm just so glad that someone who had seen her is here now to talk to me." And my heart broke with that. She ended up passing. I apologize. This is just a really hard story to read. Back to main text. A few days after, he went home and I didn't see him, so I don't know how he took it. He wasn't able to see her before she passed. We wear personal air purification respirators on our heads. These big white domes over our heads with a respirator hose going to a machine strapped around our waist, and we look like astronauts walking through the unit, going in and out of patients' rooms with our plastic gowns and gloves. It can be frightening to family members if they're allowed to come to visit, and definitely for the patients because we're kind of scary looking. It can be frantic at times. You walk through a hall and you see a lot of patients on ventilators. You hear a lot of beeping. People are rounding constantly to check on patients. It's a busy place. You don't know what to tell family members when you see them. What can you say? You just say, "I'm sorry." You can't even hug them. I used to be able to hug family members, but you can't with all this gear. When patients are scared, I will hold their hand even though I'm wearing gloves. I look them in the eyes as much as I can because really that's all you can see. You can't see our faces. You can barely even hear past the mask. So I'll make sure to look at them. I try to make an effort to smile with my eyes and to just hold their hand if they need it. As told to Aaron Chan Ding. Murray, Utah. As of December 8th, Utah has seen 217,638 total confirmed cases and 949 deaths. Tammy Cochernahan's, 41, respiratory ICU, Intermountain Healthcare. These patients are different than the typical patient. They're very complex. They can change in the blink of an eye. And it's very hard as a nurse when you wrap your heart and soul into taking care of these patients. I started noticing that I was emotionally tired. I was physically completely exhausted, and I was beginning to question whether or not I could continue forward being a nurse at all. I was past my physical capacity. I happened to be working a day where another healthcare worker who was a veteran said that this was like a combat zone. And for some reason in my head, that validated the way I was feeling. So I reached out to one of my best friends who is a veteran, a flight medic, and he said, "I meditate and do yoga." Once I started doing that, I was able to handle the emotional crises, the physical pain of working so many long, hard hours. We do something called proning, where you take patients and flip them over onto their bellies. And that sounds really easy, but it takes a team of a minimum of 5 people. It is extremely taxing on your body. It hurts, and I lift weights. The meditation and yoga has really saved my life, my mental capacity, my spiritual capacity, my physical capacity, everything that is required to give to these patients. Hopefully by 8 p.m., I'm out in the parking lot, and I spend a minute in my car to unload from my day. It's all about taking a moment to breathe for myself and then going through whatever came up that day that I need to let go of. It depends on how complicated my patient was that day, whether I can let my whole day go or if I have to spend time to go through each piece and work it down to what did I do right? Did I miss something? Sometimes I just can't let some details go quickly, and I have to work them down to allow myself to say, I did everything that I could possibly could for this individual this day, in this time, in this situation. And whatever the outcome was or is, I followed protocol. I did everything I knew how to do, and it's going to be okay. I find it very frustrating when I go out and about on my days off, and I see people very blatantly not wearing masks or trying to tell me how come they don't work or telling me that this pandemic isn't real. I find it completely disrespectful to the work we do to save people's lives, to have people think that this pandemic isn't real, to show utter disregard for people around them, not trying to do their part. And I really wish that I could take people on a day with me so that they can see what I see, so that they can feel your feet ache so bad that you wish they'd just fall off, because you're on that concrete for so many hours. Your back aches because you're wearing equipment to save your life, so that you can save somebody else's life. And your head hurts. I've never had so many headaches in my life, because part of the equipment sits on your head. And after 12 hours, it starts to exert so much pressure that you start to have a headache and you're dehydrated. Early in the pandemic, I remember walking into this room and this young patient was crying and asked me if they were going to die. And I'm a mom of teenagers. For me, that was awful because this patient was all alone and we as staff were minimizing contact because we didn't want to get the virus. This patient started physically trembling in the bed. I couldn't take it anymore, and I went over and just held this patient, because that's what I'd want somebody to do for my children. That was my first patient that I held like that, and there have been so many ever since. As told to Andrew Becker. Murray, Utah, as of December 8th, Utah has seen 217,638 total confirmed cases and 949 deaths. Nate Smithson, 28, respiratory ICU, Intermountain Healthcare. A few weeks ago, my wife and I were on a date at a restaurant, and in the middle of nowhere, I had this panic attack and went and hid in the bathroom stall for half an hour. I have no idea what brought it on. I just couldn't handle being there right then, which was weird for me. That's the first time anything like that has happened. But since then, it's happened multiple times where the anxiety and stress is overwhelming, and I can't handle it, so I have to go and excuse myself for a little bit. Balancing work and life is something that used to seem possible. Now it doesn't seem like there is any difference between the two. I fall asleep and I dream about my patients. When we got our first COVID patient in February in the hospital, in the ICU, we all kind of thought it was a little bit of a joke, to be honest. I had this patient and he was sitting there with minimal amounts of oxygen in the room, just watching TV. He's like, I'm fine. I don't know why everyone's freaking out about this. And I thought the same thing. And then a few hours later, he stands to go pee. And I'm looking at his monitor, and it drops down to the low 90s. 92 is about as low as you want to go. And then it starts dropping down lower, to about the 70s. Then it gets down to the 60s and 50s, and that's dangerous territory. That's where brain cells start dying and you start having some serious problems. I run into the room, we get him back into bed, and throw all the oxygen that we have in the room on him, crank everything up, and he's not recovering from it. We had to intubate right then and there, and about an hour later, he finally starts recovering a little bit. But at this point, he's sedated. He's on the ventilator. Everything is worse. And that's the first time where it's like, oh crap, this is serious. This is something else. I've never seen anything like that before. If a patient's heart stops or if they stop breathing, we call a code blue. And that's when the doctor, respiratory therapist, nurses, everybody comes into the room. We start chest compressions or CPR or that kind of stuff. This one patient's heart is not working, so I call code blue. We all get in there. We start doing the chest compressions. 5 minutes later, we get the patient back. We all go about our work. 20 minutes later, same thing happens again. We start doing the chest compressions. We start pushing medications as fast as we can get to the patient back again. The spouse comes into the hospital. I explain, just so you know, this is what happened before. It could possibly happen again. If it does, I'm going to need you to step outside the room. And as I am explaining this, sure enough, it happens again. We lose the pulse. We lose the heartbeat. So I ask her to leave the room. Everyone gets in there and we start going for it. We went for almost 2 hours. Chest compressions, pushing medications, shocking the patient's heart. The doctor is ultimately the one who makes the decision about when we stop and they call time of death. But typically in situations like that, where it's unexpected and sudden, they want to make sure that everybody can go home that night feeling okay about what they did, knowing that they did everything. And after an hour, he stops, turns to the room and asks, "Does anyone have a problem with us stopping?" I didn't have a problem, but then as he's saying that, I look out the window and the patient's wife is just watching us. She's been sitting out there watching us for an hour, and no one's saying anything. And I asked them to keep going, so we did. We went almost for another hour after that, and we didn't get the patient back. He ended up dying. But I think for me, that was important, to keep going. Not because we thought we would get them back, but so that his wife would know that we did everything we could. I still go to bed with her face kind of burned into my mind, of just seeing her sitting out there watching us, and that's what kills me. As told to Andrew Becker. Columbus, Ohio. As of December 8th, Ohio has seen 484,297 total confirmed cases and 7,022 deaths. Kalia Anderson, 32. ICU, Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. I graduated from nursing school in May 2019. I started here at the Wexner in August. Our orientation is a 20-week program, and so I came out on my own January 12, 2020. The pandemic hit us at the end of February. In nursing school, I think your biggest fears are making med errors, or harming your patient in some way, or just not knowing how to do everything. Did I check my patient's blood pressure before I gave this blood pressure medication? Or did I give the correct dose of a specific medication? I had heard stories about that on the unit, like, make sure you're careful with the needle stick, or make sure you're careful with this medication. And I don't even think about those kinds of things anymore. Now it's the fear of the unknown. It's the fear that anything could happen because of this virus, and my patient could die regardless of what I do. When I got my first COVID-positive patient, I remember thinking, somebody did the assignment wrong because there's no way that they believe that I should be taking care of this patient. I can remember the feeling. I can remember the day. It was a weekend. I was on a day shift. And I was thinking to myself, who trusted me, the new nurse, to take care of a COVID-positive patient? How am I going to do this? How am I going to keep this patient safe? How am I going to keep myself safe? Am I safe? Wait, who cares about me? Let's get back to the patient. What do they need? At the time, I didn't even understand some of the ventilator settings because I was still that new and it was still that fresh to me. And I thought, this machine is doing that much work for them and I don't know enough about it, but I'm going to make sure that I get it done. I'm going to figure it out today to make sure that this patient gets everything they need. And I'm going to call their family and double check with them and check in with them and call them. That patient is alive. That patient is no longer in the hospital. As far as I know, that patient is home and safe with family. I would feel like there's someone more experienced. There's someone more adequate to deal with this. And I was like, oh, it's me. This is me. I'm doing this. And I've been doing it ever since. I saw new nurses come out of orientation, and I saw the type of assignments that they would get. So my mind was fixated on, like, I'm going to get patients that are ready to transfer out. They can talk. They can eat. They're just waiting for a bed on another unit. Or maybe it's a patient who needs long-term care, so they're waiting to go to a facility to be discharged. And so I was thinking to myself, I'm going to get my feet wet. It's going to be great. I'm going to build up this experience, and then I'm going to start getting sicker patients, and I'm going to be ready. Once COVID hit, there was no room for those types of patients anymore. Everyone had COVID. Everyone was sick. Everyone was intubated or approaching intubation. And for me, I just wanted my first experience. I wanted to have the simple experience of building and getting better, but that's not what was in store, and I can't say that I'm upset about it today. I'm grateful for this experience. I don't wish this pandemic on anyone. I wish it was not here. I wish that it was different. But as a nurse, as a new nurse, these experiences are unique to me. It's making me a better nurse. It's made me a better person, and I can only continue to just be. We did cry in the beginning, and now not so much. I think we all struggled when we had a young death. Someone in their 20s was very difficult for us, because you think, that was a young life. What a young life that was, and they're not here anymore. Because of a virus, that's hard. It's very hard. But now it's almost everyone's story. As told to Jasmine Hilton. And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, December 8th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up, we'll bring you some Christmas music to take us up to 2 o'clock, and then we'll bring you the local news, or actually, we'll bring you USA Today with national news at 2. At 3, it's our local news broadcast, and here are some of the articles that our volunteers are reading today. From the Midland Reporter Telegram, hospital officials still avoiding transferring patients. Interim MISD superintendent's new calendar all about academics. Number of total COVID cases tops 11,000 in Midland. It took 1 week to add another 1,000 COVID cases for the total for December. From the Odessa American, court okays plan to help nonprofits. Pecos gets new grocery store. Federal grand jury indicts 5 in connection to defrauding banks. Those articles and more are coming up at 3 p.m. and at 6 p.m., more news from the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for joining us today. We will be back again 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
This is a recording library of West Texas Community Update.
The Medical Center Hospital ProCare primary care physicians and specialists are continuing to provide care during the COVID-19 pandemic through telehealth visits. This allows established and new patients to visit with a doctor from the comfort of their own homes. Patients can connect directly with a provider from their smartphone, computer, or tablet. Simply call one of our MCH ProCare offices to schedule an appointment. For a list of providers, they can also visit procareodessa.com/find-a-physician or call 640-6468 for more information. Medical Center Health System and MCH ProCare want the community to know we are here for the community during these uncertain times and that we are dedicated to continue making sure West Texans are treated and taken care of.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
in a one-horse sleigh. Giddy up, jingle horse, pick up your feet, jingle around the clock. Mix and mingle in a jingling beat. That's the jingle bell, that's the jingle bell, that's the jingle bell rock.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 69 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA Today, Tuesday.